Welcome, and thank you for listening in to this message from Cross and Crown Baptist Church. We hope the following message will be a great blessing and encouragement to you. More messages from the pulpit of Cross and Crown Baptist Church are available weekly from our website at www.crossandcrownbaptist.org. We invite you to open your Bible and your heart for the preaching of God's holy word.
So Matthew chapter 28, let's start there. And the kids can go on our, that's right, BJ, you lead the charge that way, okay? Presley, just make sure they walk that way and then make the corner there towards the fellowship hall, not out the front door, okay? Sometimes they can get lost, I understand. I've got a kid of my own, so he gets lost quite frequently when I tell him to go somewhere, so. You also have to, I have discovered with parenting, you have to watch what you say around your kids now, so, and I should have realized that with young people. I don't know if in your house, if the word shut up is a bad word in your house or not. Growing up, it was for me. I was outside doing something outside in the backyard the other day, and I happened to, my dog was making me, was getting on my nerves by whining every 30 seconds at me. And so I finally just, my son was out there, and I forgot he was out there, and I just finally yelled at my dog. I lost my temper, and I just said, Reese's, shut up. And all of a sudden my son goes, Reese's, shut up. And I was like, oh no. And then so this morning we walk outside to head to church and walks outside and a bird just made a bird sound. And all of a sudden I hear, shut up. And I was like, I've failed as a parent. So mind, watch what you say around your two-year-olds, all right? So they do, they're like little parrots. They repeat you, so. I was like, lesson on parenting 101 right there. Should have read that in the manual too. So, Matthew chapter 28. Matthew chapter 28 here today. We're going to be talking. I want to talk to us here tonight about reaching the next generation. And I think we've got some good thoughts, or at least I hope you find it helpful as we go into this. I want to kind of do a little bit of intro here. And then we'll explain where I'm heading with this. Obviously, reaching the next generation is something that I do value. I am a youth pastor. It is something that I believe strongly in, and I want to give us that burden here tonight. And also just help us in understanding the next generation, as we'll see in a second. If we don't understand the generation, we're not going to be able to reach them. And so we need to understand some of the struggles. We need to know how they think. We need to know what is going on in their lives if we're going to be able to reach them effectively. And so I hope this is a help to you. Some of you may say, well, I don't have any kids even near that age. That's right. You know kids that age, maybe your grandparents now, or maybe your aunts and uncles to kids that age. And some of the stuff that we'll go over will be super helpful for you as well. But Matthew chapter 28. Starting in verse 18, it says, Jesus came and spake unto them, and he said, all power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Go ye therefore, and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things, and teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Amen. Jesus here, the last thing that he says before he heads up into heaven is interesting here. The very last thing he says, of all the things he could have told us to do, there's a lot, couldn't there have been? There could have been a lot of things he could have left us with right there as the very last thing. But the last thing he wanted to remind his disciples about is this, that, hey, when I leave, you have a new direction of life now. You have a new mandate that I want you to carry out for me. I'm leaving you on earth so that you can go out and reach this world for Christ. And so he goes here in Matthew chapter 28 and he says what we call as the Great Commission. I'm going to have a lot of slides here tonight and sometimes they may not be as readable as I would like them to, but we'll get through them, okay? Hopefully I'll read through them well enough. The Great Commission there is something I want us to think about here real quickly as well. The Great Commission is not just to go out and to get people saved. He says very specifically in Matthew chapter 28 that the Great Commission is to go out and make disciples, not just converts. Converts can follow a religion, but will not always follow the master, the Jesus Christ himself, a disciple. See, a disciple and a fan are two different things. A disciple is a follower of Jesus Christ, one who has committed to living for God no matter the social, the economic, the cultural, the familial, the personal sacrifices one must make. Someone has put it this way. There's a huge difference between a follower of Christ and a fan of Christ. A follower is in it no matter what. A fan of Christ is in it if it's easy for him. There's a lot of those even in, you know, we have with sports fans, right? You know, you got the fair weather fans. They're all jumping on board as soon as they win the national championship. Yeah, that's my team, you know, because I'm on a winning team. And then next year when they do horrible, you're like, yep, I'm going with the other team, okay? Hey, our goal in the church is to make disciples. We're to be helping people come to a point in their life that no matter the consequences, they are willing to follow Jesus Christ. And in our culture, in our country, can I just put it this way? It's pretty easy to follow Jesus Christ. There's not a whole lot that we have to give up normally to follow him. But in other countries, they understand the idea of discipleship probably way better than we do, because in other countries, to become a follower of Christ means that you could be killed, means that you could lose every bit of financial stability you have. You could lose every bit of your family ties by following Jesus Christ, but we don't understand that in our country very well today. And yet Jesus Christ said, I want you to go out and I want you to make disciples. And he says this, he says, I want you to make disciples of every ethnicity, of every nation, all nations. There's not one. He says, hey, listen, the great thing about the church is this. The church is designed to be multi-ethnic. And I'm thankful that we have a church in the heart of Clarksville, Tennessee that is multi-ethnic. That it is not just of one ethnicity, some people use the term of one race, but the truth of the matter is we are all the same race, all right? All right, there are many ethnicities in one race, and Jesus says, I want you to make disciples of all nations. Well, I think that goes without saying that not just of all nations. This means that if we are going to accomplish this, then we must be making disciples of all generations as well, not just of every single ethnicity. He says the idea is this: generational discipleship is a mandate that God has given us. I want to show us this just briefly here today. And in the Old Testament, it's very clear. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 6, would you? Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse number 4. Deuteronomy chapter 6, if I can find the book of Deuteronomy. I'm going to take this off if you guys don't get too offended. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse number 4, it says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. It says, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And here's where it is interesting. Here's the principle of being generational in our discipleship. Remember, we're not just trying to work with having our own children get saved. We want them to become disciples. Remember, we're not just wanting other people to get saved. We want them to be disciples. And so he says this in verse 7, Thou shalt teach them diligently. What shall I teach them? The commandments I should teach those unto my children. And thou shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest in the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the post of thy house and on thy gates. What he's saying is this: hey, all of these things that I'm giving you, there will come a day where it's going to be so fresh and new to you because I've just given it to you. You've just accepted this. But now you have children that are coming up, and God told the nation of Israel, your responsibility as a parent is to teach them what I have given you. It's generational. The book of Proverbs, interestingly enough, the book of Proverbs is an entire book written from a father to a son.
It's generational truth. He's trying to help his son become a disciple, to say, hey, here's how to live life. I'm trying to teach you how to do it. And he writes an entire book to him. There's little proverbs that are collected, and most of them are written from a father to a son. You say, is generational discipleship important? Yes, absolutely. Look at the book of Judges. You know what the entire book of Judges is about? There was the one generation that followed God, but they didn't reach the next generation. And as soon as that generation came on the scene, they forgot God, they forsook Him, they followed other false idols, they went into a judgment, they came out of that judgment when they got right with God, they came back around, but they never reached the next generation. And so the next generation fell into the same situations. And it produced this cycle effect that just kept getting worse and worse. Why? Because they never reached the next generation. See, generational discipleship is a biblical principle that we as a church must be absolutely focused on. Not only is it in the Old Testament, but it's in the New Testament. Look at Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19, verse 13. Matthew chapter 19, verse 13 says this, then were there brought unto him little children. This is to Jesus, and he should put his hands on them and pray. But his disciples, what's the word? Rebuked them. They said, no, get Jesus, he's got more important things to do. Don't bring the little kids to him. No, come on, parents, get with the program here. Jesus is way more important than touching your snotty little nose kids, all right? He's got more important things. He's going to go heal some sickness. Maybe he should have healed the sniffles, but I don't know. They said, they don't have enough to do. He's got too much here to do to bother with kids. But Jesus turned around and Jesus said, verse 14, he said, suffer or allow the little children and forbid them not to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. See, Jesus understood that. He said, the kingdom of heaven belongs to these little children. I want to reach them. And in some ways, in a lot of ways, the best opportunities to reach people with the gospel is at a young age, when their heart is tender, before it's been hardened by the world. It's so much easier to reach them when they're younger. And Jesus understood that principle. We've got to reach them now. The generational principle. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, even the Apostle Paul gives us the idea of generational principles. But 2 Timothy chapter 2, he says this to Timothy. Let's see if I can find there myself, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse number 1. He says, Thou therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Jesus Christ. And the things, this is the generational principle, and the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. Do you see the generational principle that he said there? He said, hey, I learned some things and I taught them to you, Timothy. And Timothy, your responsibility is to teach them to other faithful men, to make disciples, so that those men can teach other people to make disciples. And then those people can teach other people to make disciples. Are you following? It's a generational mandate that God has planned of reaching this world. We are to be focused on reaching the next generation. It's something that is vital in our day and age. So the question remains, if generational evangelism and discipleship is a mandate of Scripture, then the question is, what is stopping us from reaching them? I want to give us two misconceptions here that may stop us from reaching this generation here quickly. And this is a lot of overview before we get into some very practical applications for this. Okay, common misconception number one, it's the youth pastor's job to reach this generation, or the pastor's job to reach this generation. I wrote it in all caps and lots of exclamation points. Wrong. I cannot reach this generation by myself. Pastor Craig cannot reach this generation by myself. Nobody in here can reach this generation by themselves. It is every born-again believer's responsibility to reach this next generation. We as a church are to be involved together in reaching this generation. You know why we have children's ministries? You know why we have youth groups? Because we believe as a church in the ministry of reaching the next generation. You know why Miss Becky is in the back teaching kids right now Bible stories and the Word of God and also choir and bell choir? Is because she believes in reaching the next generation to serve God. We are to be involved together as a church. Interestingly enough, in Titus chapter 2, again, Paul is talking here and he says, hey, I just want to show you what is the church supposed to be doing? And he says this, he says in chapter 2, verse number 3, he says, the aged women likewise, I want you to teach them to be... the aged women likewise, that they should be in behavior as becoming holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they should teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. Young men likewise exhort to be sober-minded. In other words, what he's saying right here, he says, hey, the older generation's job, especially in the church, is to come alongside the younger generation and help disciple them, to help teach them how they're to practically live life. He says, exhort them, admonish them, teach them how to do it. It's a generational principle. It's not just the pastor's job. If you're a born-again believer, God has called you to reach and disciple the next generation. Right. Misconception number 2. I can reach this generation the same way that the previous generations have been reached. Yes and no. Okay, I want to start that off with yes and no. Yes in this way. Look at Romans chapter 1 with me. We got a lot of Bible here at the beginning. Romans chapter 1. Again, the Apostle Paul speaking to us. And he says in verse number 14, he says, I am a debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. So much as in me, so much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also. Verse 16, for I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the what? Power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. You say, can I reach the generation the same way as we reached the previous one? Yes and no. Yes, in the fact that the message of the gospel never changes. Amen. It is the power of God in every generation. Let me ask you this. Does the gospel have the answers to every culture's issues? Absolutely, it does. And so before we go any further, and so that we are not misunderstood in things I will say in just a few minutes, the message of the gospel cannot change. For it is what convicts the sinner. It is what God uses. He says, faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. So if I do not have the Word of God, I do not have the power to reach this generation. Are you following? So yes, I have to have the Word of God in there. But no, I cannot reach this next generation in this way, the same way. The presentation of and foundation for the gospel to be understood may have to be different from culture to culture, and I would say from generation even to generation. Okay, let me explain this, okay? Because I don't want anyone to throw stones or hymn books at me, okay? Let's give a little background. The idea of worldview. Anyone heard the term of worldview before? Okay, worldview is the way in which I view every aspect of life. We all have one. We all look at it through a certain lens, okay? Religion, history, family background. There's a lot of different factors that play a part in forming one's worldview. It's not just religion, although the religion that is prominent in certain areas really affect their worldview, okay? Hinduism, Islam, any of those countries that deal with those, especially those type of religions, and really any religion that is prominent in a country, shapes our worldview. Even up until recently, as we have seen, America is no longer a Christian country. If you guys didn't know that, we really are living in a post-Christian world. Okay, but the Judeo-Christian worldview was very prominent in our country for many, many years. And so it really shaped our worldview. So with that idea, every worldview across the world has its unique challenges when sharing the gospel. You say, what do you mean? Hinduism, because of their worldview and the religion of a multitude of gods, a plurality of gods, they have to be approached very differently than someone who holds a Judeo-Christian worldview of one God. Okay, if I were to go and preach the gospel to a Hindu person, okay, who believed in Hinduism, okay, I could give them the gospel and say, oh yes, Jesus is the Son of God, and if you're going to get saved, you need to accept Jesus Christ as the Son of God. You know what they'd tell me? Great! That's awesome! I'll do it! Great, I got a convert! You know what they just did? They just took Jesus, added him to their shelf of the 1,000 other idols they've got. So I've got to first, before I can bridge that gap of getting them to understand Jesus is the Savior, I've got them to first get to understand that there is only one God, and Jesus is that God, the Son of God. I've got to get them to take down all the other idols first so they can put him up as the only God. Are you tracking with me? Every worldview has an issue like that. You have to reach them a different way. Some worldviews, we think of in some of the Arab countries, and especially because of the issue of the religion of Islam. Islam does not believe in a personal God. So as I approach them with the gospel, you know what a great opportunity to approach them with the gospel is? By the way, Allah and our God is not the same God. I know many people like to try to throw that out there. It may be the Arabic word for God, but it's not the same God. If you read their Quran, he's not even described the same way. And he's not a personal God, nor is he a forgiving God. So especially if I come to somebody from that worldview of Islam, I can really approach it from, make it super attractive in the fact that God is a God who forgives. He's a personable God. Are you tracking with me where I'm heading? Every culture has its unique situation that we have to approach differently. Hand in hand with worldview is culture here. And Harvey M. Kahn, wrote in this in the Evangelical Dictionary of Missions. He said, culture is this. It's common ideas, feelings, and values that guide community and personal behavior, that organize and regulate what the group thinks, feels, and does about God, the world, and humanity. So as we're looking at culture, we have to understand this. Culture, therefore, differs not just from country to country, but truly, and we know this here in the States, culture differentiates itself from state to state. It really does. If you don't know that, you guys, most of y'all are military or have had a military experience of traveling around. I've lived in 8 different states in my life, okay? Every state is very different. I went to school in Wisconsin. It's super weird up there, okay? They say words really strange, you know? They say bag and dragon and stuff like that, and it's strange, and I have no idea what they're talking about. And they're super involved, and they like their cheese for whatever reason, okay? It's really strange, but the South's got some interesting things too, okay? You know, chicken and waffles. Want to die from a heart attack quick? That's the way to do it, okay? Every state's got has a different culture. But even from city to city has a different culture. Sometimes even from zip code to zip code has a different culture. My wife grew up there up in the area of Wisconsin in a town called Sussex. The church that she's from is in a suburbs called Menominee Falls. Menominee Falls is a predominantly white suburb. It's very wealthy. Most of the areas in that in the suburbs are just, they just got a lot of money. I don't know where they get it from. I don't know what's up there besides cheese, but maybe it's maybe there's a lot of wealth in cheese. I don't know, but they got a lot of money up there. Interesting enough, you go their church sits basically right on the line of Menominee Falls and entering into Milwaukee. Milwaukee is a whole different jungle than Menominee Falls. It is two different cultures. There is no, it is super, super different. You can run bus ministries into Milwaukee all year long, but unless you understand that culture, you're not reaching them because it's two different worlds. And I've seen it with those bus kids. There's a lot of minorities that tend to be there. There's a lot of low income that ends up being there. A lot of different issues, a lot of broken families that you don't find on that other side of Menominee Falls. And so it's two different worlds. Two different, is it safe to say, two different cultures. It really is. And so to reach that culture, I have to understand it. But culture can change not just from city to city, but I think it's safe to say that culture can be different from generation to generation. And some of y'all know that because you've seen several generations come up and you're like, I have no idea what they're even wearing. That's just weird, you know? Well, just case in point, we're looking back and saying the same thing too. What were you guys wearing? You know, it's strange. So every generation has a different culture here. So, number 10, if I'm going to reach the next generation, then I must be willing to work with them in the culture that I find them in, okay? And here's where I want you to understand me. I'm going to use a word that some people will throw hymn books at me, but it's not a bad word, okay? It's this idea of cultural contextualization, and that's a big word. I'm surprised I got that one out here. Cultural contextualization is simply this idea, okay? It has been, let me start say this first, it has been taken to the extreme in a bad way at times. This cultural contextualization has been taken to the extreme that I can do whatever I want. I can be exactly like the culture to reach the culture, okay? That's not what I'm referring to. What I am referring to is the ability to take the unchanging truths of the gospel and present it in a way that makes sense to a culture and removes any unnecessary hurdles to accepting the gospel. You say, is that biblical? Absolutely. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And then look at verse 19. This again, Paul is writing to the Corinthian church, just trying to explain some things of how he reached people with the gospel. And in verse 19 he says, "For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more." He said, "Unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law." Like we could switch that word out, gain, as win them. I could win them for God. He says, "To them that are without the law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law of Christ," he says, "that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some." You know what he was saying? He said he was trying his best not to unnecessarily offend anybody so he could reach them with the gospel. He wasn't trying to go out and be the hipster on the street, you know, and look exactly like the lost world. What he was trying to do is, as a Jewish guy, he said this, "You know what? My Jewishness that I could be proud of, when I'm going to go reach the Greeks, I don't have to hold on to my Jewishness. I can eat with the food the Greeks eat. I can participate in the things that are not ungodly. I can do those with them to reach them." With the Jews, he said, "You know what? When I come back and I'm trying to reach the Jewish people, you know what? I'm not pulling out my bacon sandwich. You know? I'm not going to do it. I'm going to unnecessarily offend them. I'm not going to be able to reach them." That's the idea that I'm referring to as cultural contextualization. Pastor Tommy Thompson put it this way, is contextualization, or changing, is not about compromise. It is about removing anything that hinders us from getting people to Jesus. The methods change, but the missions never do. You know that from every generation, we may have to change the method slightly. Pastor Lucas put it this way, in our culture, if you haven't realized this, our culture it has shifted from the last 40 to 50 years. It used to be very common that you could go door to door. It is not as common to have people come to the door anymore. Even Pastor and I were talking about this as we've gone out. It's almost rare to have somebody come to the door and try to, will allow you to engage in a conversation. It's just awkward to do that now. Whereas before, it wasn't. And so maybe the method has to change to some degree. There may be ways, as Pastor Lucas has put it before, you know what, we'll try different lures. We're going to win people no matter how. You know, we're going to go try the fly fishing. I'll try a worm. I'll try a little, jiggly thingy. I'll try a stick of dynamite. I don't know. I'll try anything, okay? I've got to change my method if I'm going to reach this world. He says this, while we are not of this world or to be conformed to this world, because this is where we have to make sure we balance this idea before we head into this topic. He says, while we are not to be of this world or conformed to this world, Romans chapter 1 and 2, we are in this world, and therefore, if I am to reach it, I do have to understand the culture. If I do not understand the people I'm trying to reach and understand the culture within which they live and think, then I will never be able to reach them effectively. I do have to know how this next generation thinks, because otherwise I'll be beating my head against the wall thinking, why can I not reach them? Maybe because I'm not thinking like how they're thinking, and I'm not giving them the presentation of the gospel the way that makes sense to that generation. I mentioned this. Does the gospel have power to answer every culture's issues? Absolutely. Then is it safe to say that the gospel can be shared to every culture, every generation, in a way that is attractive to that culture without watering down the unattractiveness of the message? There was a pastor put it this way. The gospel is an offensive message, is it not? It is. We don't like to think so, but it kind of is. You know what at the crux of the gospel is? You're a sinner, and you're on your way to hell. That's not a nice message no matter which culture you go to and try to tell. But that doesn't mean that doesn't mean that there should be anything else as much as possible that is offensive in maybe even my presentation of that gospel. If it means that if I can take out the offensiveness of my presentation, the gospel is offensive as it is. I've got to make sure that is the only thing that is being offensive. In other words, maybe there's a method that is just, it does not work in this younger generation. We've got to be willing to say, I'm trying to find whatever way I can to get the gospel to them so I can make disciples. Are you guys tracking with me? Okay, don't throw hymn books at me yet, okay? I'll explain some more here. I want to read you this thought here Tim Keller wrote this. He said, contextualization is not, as it is often argued, giving people what they want to hear. Rather, it is giving people the Bible's answers which they may not at all want to hear to questions about life that people in a particular time and place are asking in languages and forms that they can comprehend. Sound contextualization means translating and adapting the communication and ministry of the gospel into a particular culture, not changing the gospel without compromising, he says, without compromising the essence and particulars of the gospel itself. Another guy put it this way here. Misunderstanding of contextualization has led people to argue that cultural reflection and contextualization are at best distractions and at worst sinful. He said they admonish us to abandon these things and focus simply on the Bible. While this sounds virtuous, it ends up being foolish for two reasons. First, as we've already seen, the Bible itself exhorts us to understand our times so that we can reach our changing world with God's eternal truth. He says to not contextualize, therefore, is a sin. And second, we all live inescapably within a particular cultural framework that shapes the way we think. Isn't that true? That we do think according to the culture around us, it does shape the way we think. And he says, therefore, so if we don't work hard to understand our context, we will fail in our task to effectively communicate the gospel. There is what he said. If we don't work hard to understand our context, we're going to fail. I gave that all as an introduction to this thought here. We have got to reach this next generation for Christ. If you haven't realized it, we have a whole new generation that is on the scenes. It used to be for many, many years, it was all about millennials.
Okay, that's old school now. All the millennials are getting old. It's a new generation on the scene. It is. Generation Z is the next generation. And can I say this? It hasn't gotten really any better in their culture. It's only gotten worse. And so if we're going to reach this generation, I came to this realization, I don't know if it was this year or last year, but all of a sudden I realized all the teenagers that I work with are all basically in a different generation than me now. It was for a little while I had a few hangovers that were still considered millennials because they had just made the very end of that framework. And then all of a sudden I realized, I started asking kids, what year were you born? And they started, quote, saying like 2000, 2005. And I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm so old now. And I'm only 28, but I feel old when I talk to you. Okay? I realized I have a whole new generation that is in my youth group. And this generation thinks differently than me. How do I reach this generation? Well, let's talk about that here for a few minutes tonight as we wrap up here. Let's take a look here real quickly at our generations. For those, there is still maybe a few of a former generation that have been referred to as the elders before the baby boomers. But the baby boomers are those mostly that were born between 1944 to 1964. Then you got Gen X. By the way, let's see here. How many baby boomers we got in here? Got any baby boomers in here? Fall within that range? Hold them up nice and proud. We love you guys. All right, okay, we got some baby boomers here. All right, how about Gen X, but we're born between 1965 and 79? How many are in that generation? Pastor Craig proudly standing in the back. There we go. I laugh because we talk about this all the time because we got Pastor Lucas on staff. He's our baby boomer, and then we've got Gen X, and then I come in as the millennial, representing the millennials here in the next one. So millennials born between 1980 and 1994. How many millennials fall in there, okay? All right. And I will say this, that sometimes we broad brush a generation. Not everyone thinks that way. Sometimes there is some differences of thinking. Millennials, we got hit kind of hard here from this last one, didn't we? That's all right. Gen Zers, all right? Gen Zers, 1995 to 2015. How many are in here that are born there? Okay. Vance, what? Vance, I forgot you're a few years younger than me, so he's still the baby there. All right. Gen Zers, let's kind of give a little bit of an overview. This one may be a little bit hard to read up there. I'm going to give you the forces real quickly, talk about the forces that form Generation Z. And some of you all, this does go from Generation Z to the millennials slightly. And some of you Generation X are fast catching up to us, okay? So I'm enjoying it, okay? Because it used to be that it was all like, oh, you millennials are on your phones too much. And then all the Gen X is like, now how do I use this thing, you know? Okay, so now you guys are finally caught us, so I'm kind of laughing here. Here you go, the forces that form Generation Z. Number one, technology. Without a doubt, one of the biggest forces that has affected our culture is technology. And I also find it humorous that, this is just my little jab here, you know, all millennials got hit really hard with talking about how much we were on technology, but I was kind of like, you know, you guys made it, so just saying, Gen X, you guys are the ones who made it for us. So anyways, 57% of Generation Z, here's something interesting. 57% of Generation Z uses screen media for 4 hours or more on an average day. Okay? Now, I know some of y'all, you said, no, my kid doesn't do that. Okay, but I want you to understand, on a national average, four or more hours is a pretty much average. 26% of Generation Z, 26 of about 69 million kids, sorry, Vance, you're not a kid, but you know, there's a wide range there, okay? 26% of 59 million in the Generation Z use it for 8 or more hours a day. It is shaping our world in a way that we're still trying to wrap our minds around. And some of us probably, and I'll be the first to admit, I'm a millennial. My iPhone unfortunately tells me how much time I've spent on it, and some days I'm like, wow, I'm getting pretty close to that 4 hours there, you know. My only excuse is that sometimes I do work on it, so maybe that's what I'll say, but anyways, some of us, we do, don't we not? It's very easy with screen media. That could be, by the way, that doesn't just mean phone. That could be social media. That could be streaming videos, movies. It could be YouTube. It could be
texting. I mean, there's all sorts of music. I mean, there's all sorts of things that we use technology for, but even more so, the millennials for sure, but even Gen Z. Gen Z is it forms them in a way, and it shapes the way they think in a way that we have really got to come alongside and help them understand how to think biblically because of the influence of the media. By the way, these things that we'll mention here, there's every pastor, and I've talked about this, but every good point, in this way, everyone has a really strong strength of your personality, right? You've got a strength and you got a weakness. Often what happens is your greatest strength that you have as a person is also can be your greatest weakness. So the same thing kind of applies here. Sometimes we'll look at this only from the viewpoint of this is a weakness. But it is also Gen Z's greatest strength because they understand technology better than any other culture before them now. And so with that, they can also reach their culture with technology in a way that even I am struggling to try to catch up to. Are you tracking with me? So technology really makes a huge difference in this. Worldview. Out of the 69 million children and teens in Gen Z, only about 4% have a biblical worldview nowadays. We are truly living in a post-Christian world. And as that is being said, we'll get into these even in a deeper setting, but with that in mind, when I go to preach the gospel or give the gospel to a teenager today, I really do have to start from the very beginning. No longer is it just so commonplace in our culture to where, oh yeah, I understand that there's a God and I understand, you know, I've heard some stories in church or, you know, I know who Adam is, I know who Noah is, I know who Jesus is. You know, there used to be when probably in the Generation X still to some degree, there used to be, well, for sure, and some in Generation X, because y'all, for sure, and some of you had where you still had prayer time allowed in schools, Bible being read in schools. So there's even that was in our culture to some degree. But now we have two generations removed from that where they're not going to church either, and now they know nothing about the Bible. In fact, they don't even may not even know who Jesus is. So you go and tell them the gospel and say, hey, Jesus can save you. That's great. Who is this Jesus? They don't know. So their worldview has changed. Identity. Forces forming Generation Z identity. One out of three teenagers say that gender is how a person feels inside, not their birth sex. The world has changed in how we think and how they think, how they perceive reality. Security. 43% of Generation Z says happiness, this is interesting, happiness is defined by financial success. 51% of Generation Z, when polled, said this, that the goal of life was to achieve happiness. We live in a truly post-Christian world. Diversity. 2 in 5 teens interact with people who are different from them compared to just 1/4 of the boomer, the baby boomer population. Parents. 40% say parents are their primary role model, but only 1/3, about 33%, say that family is core to their personal identity. Whereas most generations before them, when they would say, what do you think identifies you as a person? When I think of that and myself, my family is right up there on the top. My family does identify who I am. I'm very proud to be part of that family. Very proud to have my father. That's part of my identity. For this next generation, that's not as big of a deal to them. The family group. And by the way, you know why that probably is? Because they don't understand what a family is. Because the vast majority in our country today does not have a two-parent home anymore. They have a single-parent home. And they don't understand what true family is. And so we're dealing with some issues here as we look at Generation Z that are really changing the way we're having to think. I'm going to kind of breeze through this one because I want to finish this first point here tonight. And I'll be done here about 7:15. So you can hang with me. We'll try to finish this up here. The world according to Generation Z, number one, as we mentioned there, they're what is referred to as screenagers. Okay? If you've got any teenagers, you understand this, okay? They're one of the defining influencers. One of the defining influencers of Generation Z is that they have come to age in a world saturated by digital technology and mediated by mobile devices. They are also a unique generation in that they cannot remember a time before the internet. Okay? Even a lot of millennials cannot remember a time before the internet. I remember Windows 95, and I remember Juno and dial-up internet. Okay? And some of you, Ryan's looking at me like, what is going on? Okay? What I remember about Juno is, you know, it does all that weird little noises and stuff. Some of y'all remember time before that. You guys had to like go, you know, your Google was like a rock. You know, you wrote out your answers or something. I don't know. Okay, some of you actually had these things called encyclopedias. What? Now, you guys don't know what an encyclopedia is anymore, do you? Okay, he does. Okay, you're good. Okay. So some of you guys grew up before the internet, and so you're kind of like, okay, yeah, we're still getting used to the internet. Generation Z truly does not understand living in a world without the internet. Even a lot of us have gotten used to this. When the power outage happened here a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago, the greatest issue that was going on in most of Generation Z and millennials was like, we don't have Wi-Fi anymore. Oh no, what are we going to do? Okay, we think about going camping and we're thinking, is there electricity and Wi-Fi? Okay, we really are. And some of y'all are shaking your head. I know some of your generations are judging me right now, but that was my biggest concern. I don't have Wi-Fi. And then I thought, oh wait, I've got T-Mobile, so I'm still okay. So for whatever reason, they were still around for that moment. So I was okay for a few hours. Okay, we live in a world that is just saturated by the internet. And that is what Mark Prinsky popularized the term digital natives. If you have not realized this, and I have realized this even with my son, you can hand a toddler and younger children devices, and they can probably get through it quicker than you can. Their brains are being quickly rewired to work with technology, and it's just second nature now. Okay, it just is. There's a lot of, it's why some of you are like, how do you guys do it? How do you guys use like both fingers at the same time and talk to me and you're still typing, okay? Your brain gets rewired, it is, okay? It has also, interesting, this was kind of funny. There's a new term that has come around, nomophobia. Nomophobia is the feeling of anxiety anytime you are separated from your mobile device. And some of you all have experienced, okay? Be honest. How many have ever left your phone at home and then you're like, oh no, I've left my phone. What am I going to do? Anyone else like me? There's got to be more than that. Come on, you guys are just afraid. You guys are all liars. You know what it's like. You leave your phone at home and you're like, oh, what am I going to do? I've actually got to talk to people now, you know, right? Nomophobia. Social science scientist Jean Twenge has dubbed this generation the iGen, and she made this statement. She said, smartphones have radically changed every aspect of a teenager's life. She goes on to argue that while this generation is physically safer, that they are physiologically more vulnerable. For instance, teens are less likely, I don't know what I was typing there, they're less likely to leave their homes. They're less likely to leave their homes, drink alcohol, which is a good thing, get their driver's license and go out on dates than generations before them at the same age. But while teen pregnancies, for example, are rarer than ever, rates of teen suicide and depression have skyrocketed. Twinge believes that this is because teens live their social life on their phones, and most of the time it is spent in their rooms alone and often in distress. Interesting thought there. Look at the screen hours of social media as we've looked up there before. 33%, interestingly enough, if my clicker will work, there's 33%. No, there it is. 4 to 8 hours. 26%, 8 or more hours every single day on an average day of social media. It's very addicting. If you don't have social media, you're probably better off for it. But it can be very addicting. Many teens and young adults, Generation Z and millennials, okay, we laugh about this. We sleep with our phones, okay? Okay, some of y'all are smiling because you know you do. You check your social media before you go to sleep. And then what's the first thing you do when you wake up? You reach for your phone, don't you? Okay? Hey, this is what it has trained us to do. It is what the next generation does. And I'll just be honest, I do the same thing. I do. I've got a phone. I lay my phone on my charger beside my bed when I wake up. It's the first thing I grab. It has been programmed into my mind to have it in my hand. It is because it is so convenient. Excessive screen time in Generation Z, though, has been linked to some adverse side effects. Lack of healthy sleeping habits, addiction, lack of concentration, lack of problem-solving skills, decline of memory ability, and we could go on. According to a paper published in the Journal of Individual Psychology, Generation Z's lower cognitive regions, which stimulate impulses, are constantly being activated by the bombardment of neurological arousal provided by text messages, Facebook updates, and video games. At the same time, the so-called Google culture of learning, which is really finding answers to any question within seconds, continues to change the way Generation Z concentrates, writes, and reflects. Their capacity for linear thinking has been replaced by a new mode of thinking in which they need to take in and dish out information in a fast, just disjointed and overlapping manner. Isn't that true? The days of having to really think through a problem are gone for us. For good or bad, that is the situation. Case in point, I did well in math growing up. I don't like it, but I did well. I never flunked any classes, at least. But you know what? I think it's quite fascinating. Pastor, he is a math guy. He will think, we'll be sitting in a staff meeting. He will be asking, doing little doodles on a paper, writing, drawing out a building or something. And he'll ask me, okay, so what if you put this number into this and you do this? And he'll give me a number and I'll be like, yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. Not a clue. You know, he will sit without a calculator. He will do an entire math problem in his head and come out with the answer. And I'm like, Google, how do you do this math problem? You know, I just don't, my brain does not work that way. I have tried and I get lost after I carry the one in my brain, okay? I'm like, now, did I carry that now? Was that a two? Or? And then by that point, I'm all done. I'm like, I should have used my calculator already. This generation lives in a world when you ask them a question, they know it in 2 seconds. By the way, that can be good and bad. That's not all the way bad. They live in a world where we have more information than we know what to do with. That can be good. It can also be really bad. What is Generation Z as we wrap up? What are they doing online? They're gaming, social media, consuming entertainment, streaming services, YouTube. By the way, parents, YouTube is, if you got teenagers, YouTube is a big one, okay? And I don't know, if it may be even... Millennials were big into YouTube, but I'm seeing a big trend, especially in Generation Z, that YouTube is a really big thing. There's this term that is called of social influencers, people who have their own YouTube channel or even Instagram channel, and basically all they do is they talk about life, or they test products, or they video game all day. They're referred to as social influencers. Because why? Because they influence those who are watching them all day long. Their social influence. Social media, 45% report using social media every day, and that's an average of at least an hour a day, though I know that probably many would use it more than that. What is interesting about this generation is the proclivity of teenagers to branch outside of their existing personal network. What do I mean by that? 50% say that they use media to do these three things: meet new people, connect with consumer brands, and to stay up to date with celebrities. Okay, here's how I use social media. I connect with people I know or know through maybe a friend. You know, okay, they're a good friend of my friend. Sure, maybe. Okay, maybe. Not very likely, but maybe. Okay, that's how I do social media. Okay, and then I stalk everybody else. I'm like, yeah, I don't post. I'm just not a poster. I don't stalk anybody. I don't. I'm not really. Just teenage. No, I don't do that either. Okay. No, I don't stalk anybody, but I just don't post. I'm like, nobody wants to see what steak I'm eating, really. I mean, I don't really want to see what steak you're eating either, to be honest. But hey, you know what? It has become very popular to do. Some of y'all have friends that you don't even know. They're your friends on social media, but you don't know them. Like, they're just friends three times removed. That is becoming more common in the next generation. Okay? They're meeting new people. 18% of teenagers versus 9% of adults say that they enjoy interacting online with people that they've never met in real life. And I'm kind of like, no, that's just weird. There's been people that texted me that I don't know, and I'm kind of like gritting my teeth answering them, like, I don't know who you are really. Until I actually meet you face to face, I don't really have a huge desire to like become a friend on social media. That's just me. But that's not how the next generation is thinking. They're quickly coming to the age where they're branching out. By the way, the thought that they're connecting with celebrities. Okay, if you didn't realize this, all the movie stars and big celebrities, they have their own social media stuff. And if you have teenagers, they're following them. Okay? It's also how I know some of you know what's happening with the royal family in Britain, okay? Because they have social media. Some of you are glued to it, like, oh, they're moving away. And I'm like, I don't care, you know? We broke away from you a long time ago, so whatever you want to do, do it. Here's something interesting, okay? This is interesting. We're almost done. I'm sorry, there's a lot of information. I hope you guys aren't going to throw books at me or anything. Okay, this is something you really, parents especially, you need to understand this, okay? Parents, Generation X, if you have Facebook, and even millennials, and you're trying to figure out where your kids are on Facebook, I'll tell you, they're not. They may have a Facebook, but they probably never use it. I don't know why it took me so long to figure this out. I was like on Facebook with the teenagers here for a long time, and I was like, I never see anybody on Facebook. Where'd they all go? And they're all like, Brother Matt, who uses Facebook? So just so if I can help you out, if you have Facebook, raise your hand, and you use it regularly, raise your hand. Y'all are getting old now, okay? Generation Z doesn't use it at all. They're much more into Instagram, into Snapchat, which is basically, if you don't know the idea of Snapchat, you take a picture and it disappears 24 hours later, which I'm always kind of like, I tried it once and I got lost, and then I was like, this is too hard. And then I was like, I tried to go back to find something, and I was like, oh, wait, it disappeared. This is pointless. So anyway, so that's the idea of Snapchat, okay? But well, I don't know what I just did there, guys. Fix that for me, would you? I touched something I shouldn't have. That's right. I've got like two tablets up here, too. So yes, the millennial pastor is like, what's happening? Okay, I got three more slides here going, okay? The continual exposure to social media and social influencers on YouTube has allowed for a belief in a false reality of somebody having a perfect life, a perfect body, a perfect image, and it can never be achieved. And it's ironic that Gen Z, that they strongly agree with the statement that happiness is my ultimate goal in life. 51% say that. And yet research is constantly showing that the more time with screen activities is connected to being consistently less happy. The more time they're on it, they're seeing all this false reality thinking, I've got to get that. And then they realize, I can't get that. And it leads to depression. It leads to unhappiness. In 2012, for the first time in 24 years, teen suicide rates were higher than teen homicide rates. There's an emptiness in this next generation. They don't have the answers. They're not finding them online, and they can't figure it out. Hey guys, move to my very last, it's number 28, I can't find it on the thing. The safety and anonymity in the internet offers has also allowed for a new phenomenon that we're still wrestling with as a culture in the area of cyberbullying, okay? We sometimes can make fun of it and act like it's no big deal, but in this generation it is a big deal. And it is something that has to be addressed. It's something that needs that we as parents, as pastors and parents and church members, we need to come alongside this generation and help them through those issues because they are real issues in their life. 33% of Generation Z has experienced some form of this. Some ways it can be, I never had to deal with this, okay? I'm just being honest, so I don't know how to counsel as well in this area. I know some of you grew up in a time when you were a Christian in your school and you physically got bullied. It used to be that was the only way that it could happen. You got beat up in the playground, okay? And then you took your buddies and you went and beat him up, okay? That used to be the only way that could happen. Nowadays, the old adage, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me, is very untrue. And in this day and age, you can hide behind your screen and not really think about what you're going to say before you do it. You can say, oh, I'm just going to say it. And you don't think about how it is going to. And the bad thing about this, too, is when you are saying something in an online way, you cannot read the tone of voice. You do not understand how he's saying it, and you can take offense. It's easier to take offense, number one, because you don't know how they're saying it. But we can also very quickly, if you do anything with Facebook, one of the things that I just make it a habit not to do if I want to maintain my sanity is I don't read comments very often, especially on a very controversial post. I just choose not to. You know why? Because I'm going to beat my head against the wall. Because I'm like, especially sometimes, interestingly enough, post where there's pastors involved. Because I will be like, you just said what? You're a pastor? Where is the grace and love? They're hiding behind the screen saying it doesn't matter what I say. And it's so, so wrong. Last thing here I want to mention, then we're done here. Not only just dealing with technology in this generation, in a 2018 study, is the rise of rampant porn. 51% of male students and 32% of female students first viewed, porn before their teenage years. The average exposure to pornography among men is 12 years old. By the way, this is quickly, it used to be really looked at as only a guy problem. It's not. It goes both ways. We need to be careful with both genders. 57% of teenagers search out porn at least monthly. 27% of teens have received sex, with 15% of them having sent them. Either sexually explicit messages or pictures is becoming very prominent in this generation for that to have occurred. Interesting enough, here's something that should concern you. The view of pornography in our world has shifted. Teens and young adults ages 12 to 24 believe not recycling, is worse than viewing pornography. That tells you the state of the next generation and some of the struggles they are dealing with in the area of technology. Is it fair to say that there could be some challenges coming up? Absolutely. As parents, if we got some of these kids that you've got in this generation, there are some challenges that you have that the previous generations did not. And we're trying to come at this. Why are we doing a message on this? And why did I go over? I'm so sorry. Why did I do this? Because I want to help you say here, if we're going to reach this generation, we have to understand their challenges. We have to know how to help disciple them. We have to know how to help reach them with the gospel. We also have to help them know how they can use the strong points of their culture to help reach their own culture.